black walnut and decorated with green matted Currier and Ives hunting scenes illuminated by turtle-shell sconces. There was a bar, but all I saw were water bottles and non-alcoholic beer. The back wall was lined with tufted leather sectionals that gave spectators an unobstructed view of the 7 firing ranges in front of them. The place was crowded, and I stepped back as a diminutive blonde with a 9mm Beretta approached. I looked at the congestion and then at Tomko. "Are they all lawyers?" He nodded, the glass eye drifting off. "Good time to spray for 'em." I tried to find a familiar face, finally recognizing a striking, dark-haired woman at the bar. As the blonde half pointed the Beretta at our feet, I released Jimmy Tomko to his appointed rounds.
"Greta, you need to not point the weapon toward—"
I turned sideways and I made my way past the staging table, all the while trying to spot someone who could be Vince Osgood. They were an attractive crowd, well-dressed and coiffed, but they were lawyers, not paupers, so it was to be expected. There was a tall man holding forth at the center firing range, his voice probably sounding normal to his muffed ears and in competition to the hip-hop music. There was a small man standing with him, and I was starting to think it odd that no one was firing when the blonde who had aimed at my feet let rip with a scattered salvo, only 2 rounds out of 14 striking the paper silhouette. Jimmy Tomko raised an eyebrow at me. Just in case, I kept my front toward the range to keep from being shot. I watched as the short Latino peeled away from the tall guy so that he would intersect with me about halfway across the crowded floor. I tried to step to one side, but he countered, and we were nose to sternum. I nodded an apology and stepped to the right just as he did. I was struck by the precision of his appearance, how defined his hair and clothes seemed. As he looked up, I noticed that his pupils were very large, and that they gave his face a lifeless quality. His voice was soft and cultured. "Pardon." "No, my fault." He slipped to the side before I could continue the conversation and watched me as I made my way across the room. Joanne Fitzpatrick's eyes locked with mine as I lumbered up to her. "Hey, Joe." I looked around for effect. "What are you doing here?" She smiled. "I thought you would be happy to see a friendly face." She didn't have one of the cases that most of the people in the room carried. "You don't shoot?"
"No,
me either."
She laughed, and the smile was an exact replica of the one that was in the horseback photo in Katie's office. I took one of the bottled waters from the bar and glanced back over my shoulder, but the tiny man was gone.
"Do you know that guy I was just dancing with?"
"Who?"
"The little guy."
"No."
I nodded my head at the tall man at the center.
"Is that Osgood?"
She nodded slightly.
"He doesn't seem real broke up about his buddy Devon."
She leaned in.
"No, he doesn't."
About that time, Osgood unloaded his 9mm into the paper target at the center of the firing range. The kid was pretty good. There was a smattering of applause as he turned and took a perfunctory bow, taking just an extra moment to glance at me. I turned back to Joe.
"Come on, I'll teach you how to shoot."
Tomko handed me a tray with a box of 45 ACPs and a questioning look until I patted the small of my back. By the time I made my way to the other side of the room, Osgood was openly watching me. I gave him a tight-lipped smile and a nod, but he didn't respond. I set Joe up at range 7 along the wall in hopes that numerology would be on our side.
"I've never done this before."
I unsnapped the thumb strap from the Colt at my back, pulled it, and placed it on the counter with the slide group locked in the open position and the magazine removed.
"That's what they all say."
I palmed the 7-shot clip in my hand, dropped it to my side, and told her to pick up the 45.
"It looks old."
"Older than you."
After getting her acquainted with the particularities of the weapon, She adopted a wide stance with her arms extended. We both now wore the hearing protectors that had been hanging in the stall. She squeezed the trigger as instructed, and the big Colt jumped in her hands. It was pointed at the ceiling, but I caught her shoulder. She peered at the paper target, but could see no effect, unaware that the gun hadn't fired. I pulled one of her ear cups back. "You flinched."
"No, I didn't."
I cocked the empty 45. "Try it again, but make sure you keep your eyes open this time." I put her ear cup back, and she imitated the exact same motion, but this time the automatic stayed steady. She turned and looked at me.
"It didn't fire."
"It didn't last time, either." I showed her the clip in my hand. "The involuntary response is pretty common. You think the gun's going to jump, so you make a jump." I took the Colt, popped the mag into place, cocked the slide, and placed her hands around the gun, aimed toward the target. "Don't worry about blinking. A lot of people do it." She spoke out of the side of her mouth. "Do you?" I looked at the target. "No." She doubled her attentions on the silhouette and squeezed, all her efforts going into not blinking. The 45 blew her back, and from her expression there was no doubt in her mind that it had fired this time. We both peered at the target. There was a perforation at his left kidney on the line between the 4 and 5 score. "Much better." She smiled and pulled the ear cup back again.
"Do they all kick like that?"
I smiled back. "No. This one's just an antique. Heavy. Hard to aim. Slow rate of fire." Her smile faded quickly as she looked over my right shoulder, past the barrier, and I figured I had accomplished what I'd set out to do. She handed me the automatic and pulled her ear protectors all the way off.
"Hello, Oz."
I didn't turn but lowered the hammer on the Colt and pushed the safety. His voice wasn't what I'd expected. It was higher pitched and discordant.
"I thought I'd come over here and see who was shooting the howitzer."
It was silent except for the music and a few conversations that were still going on a little ways away.
"Who's your friend?"
Her face remained still.
"This is Walt Longmire, Katie's father."
"Oh, my God!" He was as tall as me, mid-30s, with an athletic build, a receding hairline, and the ubiquitous goatee.
"I am so sorry about your daughter."
I placed the Colt on the counter. "Thank you." He switched the Glock to his other hand, and I noticed the clip was in and the safety was off. He extended his right.
"Vince Osgood. They call me Oz."
I nodded, and he continued.
"I was a friend of Katie's."
I noticed he used the past tense, which made me want to grab his throat. "You were also a friend of Devin Conliffe?" His eyes were steady.
"I was. Did you know Devin?"
I pointed at the Glock in his left hand. "Would you mind securing that weapon before we talk?" He froze up for a second.
"It's got a safe action feature."
I did my best old boy routine. "I'm just a little nervous around unsecured firearms." He reached down and pushed the button, the picture of allocated grace.
"Sure. I'm around these things so much that they just become second nature."
"I was able to meet Devin just before the accident."
"Yeah, I heard about that."
He leaned against the stall, and I could smell his aftershave.
"You and I should talk."
I nodded and glanced at Joanne. "I agree. You might be in a position to give me a better insight as to what's going on." He puckered his lips and looked down at his $400 shoes, the picture of the all-knowing assistant D.A., if suspended, there to assist his rustic cousin.
"I think I can do that."
His head came back up.
"Where will you be later tonight?"
I thought about Lima. "I've got a dinner date this evening, but I could meet you after for a beer. You know a place called Patty O'Neill's on Race?" He watched me for just a second too long.
"Near the bridge?"
I pulled out my pocket watch. 10:30? He nodded, and I gestured toward the Glock 34. "You're pretty good with that thing." goes with the job. I wondered about lawyering in Philadelphia and picked up my Colt. You going to shoot again? Oh, yeah. How about you? I let him watch as I reloaded and replaced the .45 in the pancake holster at my back. No, thanks. He smiled and bobbed his head. I guess you're pretty good, too. Huh? Good enough to know I was cocked and locked with a full clip and one in the pipe. Good enough to know he was empty. Chapter 9.
Alphonse, if you don't turn the tourist music down, we're going somewhere else.
The restaurant had been closed, but Lena had unlocked and marched through the back door as if she owned the place. She deposited me in a small booth by the kitchen and called up the steps to Alphonse, threatening him with brimstone if he didn't come down and fix his dinner. Alphonse, the uncle, was Victor Moretti's brother, and his restaurant was quintessential Italian market, from the red and white checkered tablecloths to the battered, raffia-covered Chianti bottle with a tapered candle flickering in its throat. The booths were high-backed and worn, with the many layers of varnish making their surfaces glisten, but it was Alphonse who made Alphonse's. Alphonse Moretti must have weighed as much as I did. No mean feat, since he only stood about 5'6". "You want me to create? I have to have music." He blew through the kitchen door with a fresh bottle of wine and an assortment of water glasses, pulled the cork with his hands, and slid onto the bench with me, singing along with Frank Sinatra in a soulful duet of The Lady's a Tramp. He wore glasses, but like everything else on his face, they looked as if they were being swallowed by flesh. The only part that seemed up to the fight was his mustache, a salt-and-pepper affair that drooped past the corners of his mouth. It would have looked dour on any other man, but it gave Alphonse the look of a painter who had stuffed a brush in his mouth and had forgotten about it.
"She is beautiful, isn't she?"
Lena rested her chin in the palm of her hand and looked at him.
"Alphonse."
He poured the wine into the water glasses and slid one toward me.
"A race of principessas, not like us peasants."
Lena slouched against the wooden back of the booth and looked at me. I was sure this was a repeat performance.
"You know the island of Capri?"
He extended a chubby finger toward Lena and spilled a little wine on the table.
"This one, she will tell you she is from Positano."
"But this is not true." She picked up her glass and retreated from the candlelight.
"Al, you don't have any wine glasses?"
He gestured toward her again.
"You see, principessa."
"Al,
un pezzo di cielo caduto in terra, they call it, a piece of heaven fallen to earth. They say Lucifer stole the place and brought it to Italy, and if you want to know about beautiful women, you ask the devil."
Lena blew air from her lips in dismissal. He continued.
"You know Tiberius? The emperor that threw people off cliffs?"
I nodded.
"He had palaces built across the entire island, even moving the imperial capital to Capri."
Her voice was soft.
"Jesus, Al."
He crossed himself.
"She is a bad woman, but so delicious."
I felt Lena kicking at him under the table.
"Tiberius has all these palaces scattered across Capri. Now he needs women with whom to debauch. The word goes out across the empire that all the most voluptuous and desirable women should be brought from all Italy. Villa Jovis is the palace of palaces, so it must have the woman of all women. Tiberius has all the principessas brought to the palace and disrobed one by one."
He gestured toward Lena.
"This one's ancestor, Donna Allora, is last, and when she drops her robe, the court is silent. They have never seen a woman until they have seen this woman. The emperor must have her at once, so he takes her on the floor of the palace, with the entire court in attendance."
In the silence, I thought I should say something.
"Romantic, devil."
Lena shook her head.
"Bullshit. Allora had her revenge."
Alphonse took a drink of his wine.
"They say Tiberius was suffocated by a rival, but..."
He pointed the sausage-like finger at Lena.
"You cannot love a woman as beautiful as this. She will twist your heart."
"I wish I could twist hearts the way you twist the truth."
He was looking at me.
"I chased after this woman for 3 months, before she took my ugly brother, who was not as smart as me."
He touched my arm to make sure he had my full attention.
This one's daughter, the Terror. Works for you?
I nodded. Yes.
When she was a teenager, she used to lifeguard at the pool on Christian Street.
Alphonse? Nina's voice carried more than a little warning. He ignored her and continued.
The Terror, she used to wear this black one-piece bathing suit, a white blouse tied at the waist, and little sandals with flowers between the toes.
Al!
In the summer, the men of Christian Street always found a reason to be out on the stoop at 10 in the morning. To watch her go by.
Al!
14 years old, and she is cussing them like a sailor.
I took a sip of my own wine as Lena spoke.
If you're through with your stories, we're starving.
He looked at me.
You see? Principessa!
She leaned forward.
What are we having?
He raised his hands with a flourish.
Pizza rustica, Alphonse.
Lena clapped her hands.
My favorite.
He downed the rest of his wine, set the glass back on the table with more flourish, and stood.
I stole the recipe from Termini, but he's not here.
He disappeared through the kitchen door, singing One for My Baby, just under Frank. I raised my glass, and she touched the rim with hers. Here's to the lady's revenge and sandals with little flowers between the toes. She smiled and drank. I motioned toward the kitchen where Alphonse was overpowering Sinatra.
He's quite a character.
My ally.
He seems to enjoy life.
Her head tilted slightly. And he makes excuses for people who also make that mistake. The glass lingered there at her lower lip, a movement that echoed Vic's. When I had the affair, Alphonse let me stay above the restaurant.
You make it sound like an historic event.
She took a sip. In our family it was. She studied me.
I'd imagine you were true.
True?
You know what I mean.
I thought about it, trying to come up with some way of not sounding like a self-righteous prig.
We're always saving for something. I mean, I don't think it was that we got along all that great. There were plenty of times he would have called it quits, but it seemed we were always needing something. A new television, a washer and dryer, a car, or for Katie. It's amazing what civil service wages can do for fidelity.
She laughed, and I studied the pattern of the tablecloth.
I'm not sure how to go about this, but I think we're close enough friends that I have to tell you something.
She looked back up at me.
I think I've stumbled onto who it might have been that you had the relationship with.
Her expression changed very slightly, and then she looked at the tablecloth. It was a very long pause, and I was about to say something when she started talking.
I understand Michael threw you out of the hospital.
Yep.
He's healing fast.
She held the glass at her lip.
He got a 3-day suspension.
And it seems to me I should be mad at you about that.
I waited and then spoke very carefully.
As long as that's all you're mad at me about.
She raised a perfectly shaped eyebrow as I continued.
It was my plan, but it wasn't my idea.
I didn't care for this line of conversation either, so I changed the subject again.
I went to Delaware today. First to sign the Constitution. They have a plaque.
How was the opera?
I think your husband would just as soon I go back to Wyoming.
I'm sure he would.
I smiled and took another sip of the wine. Opening night tomorrow?
Yes, why?
I shrugged. I was looking for a date to take to Henry's opening, but I guess you're otherwise engaged. She took a long moment to respond, looking at her glass.
Yes.
It was quiet. And I watched her clench her jaw muscles. Again, she looked like Vic. We listened as Alphonse finished up on a note.
Victor really can't sing, but I think I prefer Alphonse. More heartfelt.
And flat.
She laughed, a slow laugh that pulled at the top of my chest.
So, if we can't seem to talk about anything else,
What's happening with the case?
I'm having a beer tonight at O'Neill's with an assistant district attorney. He was a friend of Devon's and was a player in the Roosevelt Boulevard thing.
Vince Osgood?
Yep. I guess it was in all the papers.
No, just recently there was something.
I let her think while I continued. Suspended. She held her hand out to stop me from speaking.
No, this was something that connected with something you said. I've heard those two names mentioned together, Osgood and Conliffe.
Roosevelt Boulevard.
No, no, no. It was something else.
She continued to think.
I know I'd heard that young man's name before, but now I can't think where.
Alphonse returned with two plates and wrapped flatware, carefully placing them on the table, and poured himself another glass of Chianti.
Alphonse, what do you know about Vince Osgood?
The assistant DA on suspension?
He tightened his lips under his mustache.
He would burn his mother to stay warm.
What about him and Devon Conliffe, the judge's son?
What about him?
He took a sip of his wine.
He fell off the bridge, end of story.
How?
He looked at me.
You know, I leave you here with this beautiful woman. Wine. Candlelight. And you talk like cops.
Lena set her glass down.
You were a cop?
Not anymore. You want to talk cop stuff? You talk to your husband. You want to talk women, wine, or song? You talk to me.
She held the glass with both hands and didn't look at him.
Do you still have those friends of yours in the DA's office?
No.
Now she looked at him.
Are you going to make me ask Victor?
He sipped and thought about it, finally sighing.
What do you want to know?
There's some kind of connection between Osgood and the Conliffe boy. Something I overheard or read somewhere, something recent.
I'll make a phone call. Tomorrow, but only on one condition.
We waited.
No more cop talk.
I called Henry from O'Neill's. He had a number of ceremonies he wanted to perform in Katie's hospital room and told me he would relieve Michael and to take the rest of the night off. I told him I wasn't sure I could do that.
Then you have to help.
I'll help. I could hear him talking to the nurses and wondered about the other patients and the upcoming rituals. How did the installation at the academy go?
Wonderfully well. They are very accommodating.
I thought about the woman with the keys and the security pass.
You are coming to the reception.
It was a statement, not a question. I can, but somebody's got to stay with Katie. There was silence on the phone.
She will be better by then.
The heat in my face hit like exhaust, and the stinging in my eyes wouldn't go away. Even across the telephone lines, he felt it.
Do me a favor?
Yep.
Wait until very late. I'm not sure that they like pagan ceremonies. And bring some eagle feathers.
The line went dead. Ian looked at me as I hung up the phone.
Trouble?
Just a little. I have to find some eagle feathers. He crossed his muscled arms on the bar, the intertwined Celtic snakes writhing up his forearms.
I'll see what I can do.
He probably got strange requests. I looked around the room and spotted an empty table near the window. The place was crowded, but not as bad as I might have suspected.
Not too busy?
The Irishman shrugged.
The band cancelled.
What happened? He slid an unasked for Yingling long neck across the bar to me.
Started drinking too early.
Irish? He smirked.
French, I think.
Damn French.
Yeah, they'll fuck off the EU, wait and see.
I glanced back at the still empty table. I think I'm going to go sit over by the window. He swallowed a fearful dollop of what the Scots call the creature.
You're too good to drink at the bar, Sheriff?
I have to meet with a lawyer.
Katie's coming?
I took a breath as I stood. No, and that's something I probably need to. It was then that I noticed Osgood standing at the front door. I raised a hand and got his attention, motioning toward the table in the corner. Ian's looks had sharpened, either at my statement or Osgood's appearance.
I'll have to tell you about it later. I'll keep me eyes out for eagle feathers. I took my beer and napkin to the table and eased my back against the wall, a good frontier sheriff.
Howdy. How are you?
I'm good. Can I buy you a drink?
He took off his suit jacket and hung it carefully on the back of his chair, loosened his tie, and rested his arms on the small table. He nodded before looking around the place.
Why'd you want to meet here? The place is a dump.
I nodded at O'Neill and turned back to Osgood.
Katie lives only about a half a block away.
Oh.
That's all he said. Ian approached, and I noticed that Osgood didn't bother to look up.
Scotch and water. Anything over 12 years old.
Ian looked at him for a second more, then turned and walked away.
I watched Osgood.
You two know each other?
The assistant district attorney shook his head.
Never seen him before.
I was pretty sure he hadn't seen him just now, either.
How's your daughter doing?
She's improving, starting to have involuntary responses.
I thought about Henry.
We brought in a specialist.
He nodded.
I hear you're doing a little investigative work.
I wondered where he had heard it. Just keeping my hand in on account of Katie. Nothing too serious. He nodded some more.
Watch out for gouter and cats.
He glanced out the window.
The kike is internal affairs and could give a shit and shake about the truth.
He continued to look at the sidewalk outside.
They've been after me for years, and I have no idea why.
Close to 10 counts, I figured. What can you tell me about Devin and Katie?
Well,
he pulled at the end of his goatee.
I was kind of hoping that we could share information, you know?
Help each other out? I nodded, all innocence. You bet.
Ian appeared with the scotch and water and motioned to my untouched beer.
You want another?
In a bit, thank you.
He nodded and glanced at Osgood, who continued to study the surface of the table.
His head came up after Ian had left. He took a sip of the scotch and rested it back on the paper napkin.
I'm assuming that your focus of interest is the connection between Devin and your daughter?
Katie. He looked at me for a moment longer.
Katie.
You'd be right.
There isn't any connection.
I looked mildly surprised.
Between what happened to Devin and what happened to to Katie.
He leaned in.
Devin was involved in a lot of shit in which he shouldn't have been involved.
I took a sip of my beer and waited.
He had a little problem, if you know what I mean.
He laid a finger alongside one nostril and sniffed.
His difficulty started with this guy Shankar Duval, who used to provide Devin's medication for him. They started working on a barter system, you know, medication for legal services rendered.
I thought about the man that I'd tackled at the crack house, the one they called Duval, but it had to be too much of a coincidence.
What's this guy Duval look like?
Black, tattoos, and one big fucker. Pharmaceuticals and firearms are his thing, something of an aficionado, I hear.
Not too much of a coincidence, as it turns out. And big enough to throw somebody off the BFB, I figured.
So what happened with him and Devin?
This ass Duval and a